Okay, and welcome back. If you missed the first hour, you missed a good one. Very interesting. It had to do with an interview of Mark Redinger by Ross Coulthart. Coulthart, unusual spelling. Now, this is unfortunate, but we're here to straighten out the record. And if the truth is not reflective of the record, what good is the truth? Not only did Mark Redinger not mention either Tom Carey or Don Schmidt regarding Roswell and their history with QFOS, he apparently took all the credit for interviewing the witnesses there, five at least, all arranged by Don, the one archaeological dig, and actually there were five digs, all led by Tom and Don. These were not mentioned. So, I mean, if you're going to, it's called the lie of omission, or you're getting old and you don't remember very well, to be polite. But this needs to be straightened out, and I hope, Mark, that you'll send a note to Tom and Don expressing your thoughts on this and what might be done to correct it. It's just not right. All the work these guys have done, heroic work, it staggers me. We wouldn't have Roswell without them, okay? It's really that simple. Now, Tom Carey was telling us about a deathbed confession that ended up with the son having knowledge of a locked secret stash, and we'll go back. Tom, set that up again, and let's walk through it. This
All
is
right.
Very interesting. Did I get that right about Mark Redinger? I want to be sure I got it right.
Yes, you did. Thank you.
Okay, good. All right. Go ahead, Tom.
Yes, the son, Bill Harrison III, is his correct name, had just been told by his father, who's on his deathbed in a hospital in Fort Worth, Texas, in 1983. And his father tells Bill Jr., I'll just call him Jr., Bill Jr., that the reason he couldn't talk about Roswell to him over the years is locked in a closet in a little metal box that itself is locked. Now, Don knows that the descriptions of the wreckage, aside from a few large pieces on the debris field, were mostly of a palm-sized shape. Palm size.
Right.
So I'm thinking, oh, it's in a little metal box. And you know what I'm thinking?
Yes, I do.
She says, it's in a locked closet. The key is here, so-and-so, and blah, blah, blah. So the son goes home to his father's home and his mother's home, and gets the key and opens the closet. And there inside the closet is his father's memorabilia, all of his uniforms, his medals that he accumulated. He called it the shiny stuff. He called it all shiny stuff, plus the uniforms and all this other stuff. And he found the little metal box, and he got the key, and he opened the metal box, and boy, I am on the edge of my seat. I'm saying, oh boy, here it comes. This is going to be earth-shaking. He's going to become a millionaire, and at least they'll have to identify us, the three of us, as getting the lead. And I said, okay, so tell me what was in the box. He says, well, in the box was a single letter. And boy, my heart sank at that point. He said there was a single letter in the box. It was from a JAG officer with the date of 2000 under the seal of the Defense Department, the JAG officer in Washington, D.C. And it's all about his father's threatening, basically threatening his father. You know, you're in retirement now. You're and blah blah blah. You have all these benefits. We'd hate to see you lose your benefits and your family's benefits if you say something untoward about you know what.
That's pretty disgusting to even hear again. You mentioned it earlier, but that is not
so. True. Thinking that this letter itself was of value,
mm-hmm.
I said, "Where is that letter now?" He said, "I burned it." And I'm thinking, "Oh,
there goes your heart must have gone down to the floor at that point."
Yes, yes. So when I picked myself up, I said, "You burned it? Why would you do that?" He said, "Well, I was starting my own career at that point. I was going to open a company of my own, and I just wanted that period of my father's life to end." And I'm thinking, this just doesn't sound right. And I didn't beat around the bush. I said, "Are you sure that's all that was in the metal box under lock and key?" "Yes, it was just a letter. I burned it." And so I left it go at that. And at that point, the call was basically over in disappointment. So I called him up again a week or two ago. And I told him, I said, "You know, Bill, I've been thinking that, you know, about the, tell me that story again about the little box. Because I'm having trouble with that." He says, "Well, there were a lot of papers in the closet, and including that letter from the JAG officer." And he says, "I took them all down to the dumpster and dumped all the papers in the dumpster." I said, "Why would you dump the papers in the dumpster? Why would you want to do that? It's your father's history. The famous, a high-ranking officer who's at Roswell. Why would you want to throw that away? I just wanted that out of our life," he said. He kept all the uniforms and the shiny stuff, as he called it. And I basically told him, I said, I don't believe you. Are you sure that was all? "Well, yes." Now, he changed the story from burning the letter to taking it to the dumpster. So when you change your story, that means
he's still
making,
got it.
You're
he
making
put all
something
those,
up.
They're put away somewhere. He moved them. That's my guess. He put them somewhere else.
Yes.
Now, given you're just a voice on the phone. So.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, and I'm just a voice on the phone. And but he did read our book. And so I said, "Bill, I'm just having trouble with this story." And so I left it with, I said, "You know, the museum down in Roswell at one point offered $1 million for an incontrovertible piece of physical wreckage. I don't know if they still have that $1 million reward, but I can tell you this, whoever comes forward with a piece of incontrovertible piece of wreckage from the Roswell will become an instant millionaire." And I left it at that. So that's how that story ended.
Now you both between you have interviewed thousands of people.
We've interviewed over 600.
Yeah.
All right. And ancillary corollaries, lots more, I bet. Anyhow. All right. These are prime witnesses. But what are your thoughts, Tom? Your radar went off. You picked up something, and I think you're correct. That is almost the ultimate disrespect for a father, if you think about it, in the traditional sense. You don't do that. You move it. You put it somewhere else.
Yeah, I just couldn't believe he would throw all of his father's history.
No, it doesn't
away.
Make sense. It just
doesn't make sense. He said, "Well, I was starting my own business." That's a non sequitur to me. It just doesn't follow. I would have saved every piece of paper. Certainly.
Absolutely. Yes. Goes without saying. You bet. You bet. Don, what are your thoughts on that?
I'd be checking every pocket in those salvaged uniforms and every square inch of that closet, even to the carpeting and anything that may even be beneath that.
Yep.
It was locked up and secured for a reason.
Yes, yes. It was locked up in a locked closet. Yeah. Don, do you remember when we went into Frank Kaufman's house after he had passed away looking for something?
Oh,
and we
thought the place was vacant and it wasn't?
And it wasn't vacant. There was somebody there. But he was an art student from Brooklyn.
He was a very good artist, yeah.
And he drew some of the aliens' bodies, but they didn't look like that at all. That's what struck me. If you remember that picture he drew of them, they were the most beautiful creatures he ever saw, something like that. And I'm thinking, what is he talking about?
Almost angelic, right?
Yes. And I still remember that picture. I don't know if the family took it or
yes,
or
the
you
family
have
took it.
It.
Right. I have a print of it.
Tell the story about he also had a piece of metal of the wreckage that I guess was go ahead. Where he pinched his wife's arm.
Right.
Tom, let me say one thing real quick. Tom, at least he didn't. The third, or whoever, I think it's the third, Harrison the third, right?
Yes.
At least he didn't say, there was this letter in there, and this little piece of old bent metal, which I threw out. I thought it was in there by accident. And you're right, it doesn't make sense. It just doesn't.
Right.
And if you change your story, that's a pretty big thing to change.
Yeah, it went from burning to taking it to
you don't throw it in the dumpster.
And it may be simply a case of where I'm in the possession of something. I have something I shouldn't have. And am I going to get in a lot of trouble if I acknowledge it? And as Tom knows as well as I do, we know of specific people whose families were involved, and we have multiple witnesses who have sworn that they still possess physical evidence, and yet when we confront them, they won't even talk about it. It's like, nope, they don't, not here, you're not going to find anything here. Well, okay, are they just protecting themselves, protecting their families? Or again, is it a case of once the cat is let out of the bag, they're the ones that are then held responsible? That threat certainly isn't coming from us as much as if they saw the level of threats coming to their very father.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And were the families included in those threats? It may involve a personal visit, or it may involve where we can provide, just as there are the whistleblower protection situation now, that it be a matter of contacting his representative, and will you provide protection? Will you acknowledge that as a potential whistleblower that he and his family will be protected? And so we'll go that gamut just for the very possibility that there is a potential chance at the Holy Grail, as Tom and I call it. But no, you're both right. That this idea that, no, I just tossed it, I just burned it, what have you. It's more of a brush-off than it is an actual, an admission of truth.
Yeah, because even the letter from the JAG officer would be of value.
Very, very big value.
Absolutely.
Very big.
especially if it specifically, if it did mention 47, if it did mention Roswell. That's a smoking gun. Because why are you being threatened 50 years after the fact?
With all the knowledge that you have and all the books and all the hours and hours, endless hours of talking to people, first-person people who were there, eyewitnesses, why, I don't understand why Roediger would pull something like that, if that's the right word to use. He's been the director of QFOS since 1986. I guess he's still there,
Since Hynek passed,
Yeah. So go ahead.
He did mention Kevin Randall and Brad Sparks. I wrote that down.
Not good enough. No.
Yeah,
Sorry.
Brad Sparks, who's a total skeptic on Roswell.
No. And, see, you know what this suggests to me, gentlemen? It suggests
it was
to me.
A snub. And it was a total snub.
That's correct. But I think that QFOS, I mean, if I were running the intel community in this country, wouldn't you, I would, set up QFOS, I would set up MUFON. Now, Walt Andrews' brother, Walt was a director, president of MUFON for 38 mm-hmm. years. I don't know.
The founder,
His brother was career CIA. Wouldn't you set up MUFON to make sure that you had first dibs on all the absolute best evidence that could come in on this subject? Well, yes, of course
you
would.
Well, we know the situation with even NICAP, National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, and how they were infiltrated by the CIA. It's factual.
Yeah. Well, why should QFOS get off without some serious questions? What's really going on here? Why aren't Tom and Don being interviewed in addition to yourself?
I don't think I'm giving anything away when I can state that for having worked for him and with him and as closely as I knew him, that J. Allen Hynek had a top security clearance with the government right up until the day he died.
Well, there you go.
And that they would have kept him after his consultation with Project Blue Book for almost 20 years, that they still would have kept him on a short leash. Have ever come up with anything that would have been necessary for the Air Force to be immediately contacted, they would have been. They would have been. And so is this just a continuation on that theme? The idea that, well, we can't very, very easily, you know, just suggest that nothing unusual was recovered at Roswell. And we can even go so far as to say, yes, it was covered up. But I think in the same sense when you were talking earlier, Jeff, about TikTok and the idea that even the Congressional Committee investigation and UAPs, they originally were only going to go back to 2004.
That's right.
When the wonderful thing, and I know Tom would agree with me wholeheartedly, the one of the great things about Roswell is that it was back at a time when the skies were pristine, that both jet and rocket propulsions were in their infancy. There were so few alternative explanations as to what people were observing in the sky, whereas today, you know, the sky is full of just about everything and anything.
Plus the computers, you can
your
make
internet
up
is full of fake video, fake
and
audio,
drones,
fake everything.
And advertising planes, and you name it. But back then, everything was so black and white. That was the wonderful thing about Roswell, that this was such an unprecedented event. And getting back even quickly to the bodies, and I certainly want Tom to chime in, because we both worked on Elazar Benavides for months, because his wife was even pleading with us, you need to get him to talk. He has to talk to you, because we haven't been able to sleep in the same bedroom for four 40 years due to what he personally witnessed at Roswell in 1947. And then when he finally broke down and he finally opened up to us and he wept like a child. He cried like a baby because it all came out. Tom, why don't you describe?
Yes, he and his wife had visited the International UFO Museum one day, and his wife went into the director's office, I think at that time it was Julie Schuster.
It was Julie,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And she said to Julie, you know, my husband was at Roswell. He has a lot of information to give you. And instead of going in the office, he ran away physically. He ran out of the museum. He did not want to talk. And I can't remember now how it was that we got to meet him personally and to get his story.
Gloria Hawker up in Albuquerque, Tom.
That's right. That's right. Gloria Hawker. She's still alive, and she was our she was our go-between between us and the family, his wife and Elazar. And so we got to meet him, and his story was that I think he was in this 390th Air Service Squadron. Or
correct. ASS. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he was one of the guards of the Silver Plates, the B-29s that carried atomic bombs. He was a guard and had a very high security clearance. And one day he was, grabbed. He had finished his shift, and he was grabbed by somebody. Get down to the big hangar, and they'll tell you what to do. We need the people to guard the hangar. This is where all the wreckage and the bodies were taken initially from the crash site. So he goes down there, and even before he gets set up, they would give you a gun, a grease gun, and there are instructions where usually if anybody tries to get into the hangar, shoot first and ask questions later. And even before he got to get his gun and stand guard, he noticed that there was a officer who had totally lost it. Subdue him. He had totally lost his demeanor. He had seen the bodies inside the hangar, and he just couldn't cope with it. And so they got control of this officer, and they carted him away, I guess, to the hospital. And they said to Elazar, they pointed to him, they said, "You, get over here. And we want you to accompany this gurney over to the hospital." And underneath the gurney was one of the dead aliens. And as they're taking this gurney over to the hospital, which wasn't too far away from the big hangar, one of the flaps on the gurney that covered the body came off, and he got a good look at the he called them, the term he had for the alien bodies were species, like a
species. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he said, I saw a species, and it had a big head. It had a big head and no nose or ears or like that. So he gave a good description of it, Jeff, and accompanied it over to the base hospital. And they took it inside, and he stood there, because he was awaiting further orders. So he's inside, and he got a look at everything. And finally, they said, I don't think he was a sergeant. I think he was a private at that time.
He was a PFC, yeah.
Yeah. He said, you're dismissed, private. And so he went back and stood guard. But that was his story. And he was one of the last surviving witnesses. I guess he's passed away now, but... he was, he survived. He was, I think he was in the 2002 Sci-Fi Channel special. I think he was interviewed there. Mm-hmm. I think he was interviewed by Rich Dolan, if memory serves me. But if I left out anything from his story, Don, you can fill it in. But that's what I remember about it. He was very cooperative. His story never changed. And he's right about not being able to sleep for 40 years or however long it was. But he saw the bodies, and the officer who had totally lost control of himself, having seen the bodies in the hangar.
See another one of the earlier accounts, but another, you know, emotional example in that even at the time when your own loved ones cannot accept, cannot believe what you're telling them. Mm-hmm. And that was Sergeant Melvin Brown, who was with K-Squad. He was with the kitchen staff. But keeping in mind, Roswell was the first atomic bomb, you know, base in the world at that time, mm-hmm. the 509 bomb mm-hmm. wing, the first atomic bomb squadron. They all had a top security clearance on that base because of the bomb. So it was no surprise that someone from K-Squad would even be assigned to be part of the operation. And it happened to be at the time of Apollo 11, the first man landing on the moon, Neil Armstrong, that Brown, who was then living in the UK, because he had been transferred to England after 1947, and he would meet his wife, and he had two daughters. And he used that occasion of the moon landing to tell them about Roswell. And he described to them that he was taken out into the desert, and he was posted behind an ambulance truck, told to keep his eyes forward. And the first chance he got, he pulled up the tarp in back of the truck, and there were a couple of the bodies. And they laughed it off. The family laughed it off. They didn't believe it.
Huh.
So it would be like 15 years later, he's dying in a hospital just outside of London. And his wife was Abigail, something like that, because we had interviewed her. And we have her on video, and then both daughters, but the one daughter specifically, Beverly Bean, she's the one that even did a couple of shows with us. But they witnessed Melvin taking his wife's hand and then assuring her, telling her that, "Sweetheart, I need you to know that I have always been faithful to you. I've always, you know, been trustworthy to our marriage vows." And then on that same level of human emotion, he tells them once again about the bodies he saw at Roswell. So in other words, his faithfulness to his wife, he placed on the same level.
Same level, yeah.
As what he saw in Roswell. So again, these people that make these, you know, blanket statements that this happened, this didn't happen, you can believe this, you can believe that, they have never been involved with the witnesses as Tom and I have been. They haven't gone through the efforts of trying to get these people to talk for months, for years, and also dealing with their families, like in the case of Elazar and his wife, who confirmed that her husband told her all about this right after they got married. So this was in the early 50s. And so the talk of the bodies goes back long before we became involved, that they were hiding on to this ultimate secret beyond, you know, the strange wreckage, the memory material that you could wad up and it would flow like water as you'd place it down. They were all talking about the little bodies, the little men. And as Kaufman himself made the comment, with CBS News reporter Phil Jones when he asked, well, how do you know they weren't from here? And I still love Kaufman's line. Well, they sure weren't from Texas.
Yeah. There was another fellow. His name is Homer Rowlett. This was another deathbed testimony. He was a sergeant. They grabbed him, and he was one of the fellas that went out to the crash site down on his hands and knees picking up anything that was not natural. And that would be the wreckage. I got somebody all choked up here. And so Homer Rowlett, he's on a gurney in the, I guess it was St. Mary's Hospital, or I don't know if they did the major surgery in the base hospital, but it was either the base hospital or St. Mary's Hospital in Roswell. And he's going there, he's out in the hallway, they're prepping him to go in and have heart surgery. And they, you know, there was no guarantee that he would come out, how long he would last. So he's out there in the hallway, and he calls his family's there. He calls his daughter, Carlene, over. Dear, come over. Come over. I want to say something to you. Come down close, and I'll whisper. So he told her, go over. Talk to your brother. He has something to tell you about Roswell. I should have told you long ago, but I never did. But I've told your brother Larry. So she does. You know, she doesn't. She's worried about her father is going to have heart surgery, and so in he goes to have heart surgery. So Carlene goes over to her brother Larry. What is Dad? What want you to tell me? And so Larry tells Carlene, now they're in the hospital, you know, waiting, you know, being your father's.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody's dying. Somebody's dying. And he tells Carlene, well, your father was out there picking up wreckage during the Roswell event, the Roswell crash. And he said he said there were bodies, but that one was still alive. So the story was that his father had seen either out in trucks or at the hospital, yeah, or at the somewhere on the big hangar. He saw the bodies, but he also was out there picking up the crash wreckage. He told his son Larry the story. But he never, for some reason, he never told his daughter, Carlene. So on his deathbed, he brings Carlene over because he doesn't know if he's going to make it or not. He says, talk to your brother, Larry. He's got something to tell you about my time at Roswell. So here he is. He should be worrying about his heart, and you know, but he's thinking of Roswell on his deathbed. Mm-hmm. And the long and the short of the story is he did survive the operation, but he died soon thereafter. So that's one of our deathbed stories.
Every one of these deathbed confessions is worthy of a documentary, of being included in a documentary specifically about this aspect of Roswell. I know I'm repeating myself, but this is a three-parter, 10 each episode, and they would go down as being some of the most overwhelmingly convincing and compelling things that people have ever heard. The way you tell it is so straight and so clean. It's something you can't dismiss.
And so did anybody, believable, because you're talking about
you're being blacklisted. Come on, that's the only explanation.
Hospital gurneys, you're talking about people in their hospital rooms, you're talking about people who realize it's the one last chance they have to finally tell the truth. And I think what people also miss is that there was a lot of wreckage there were a lot of people that managed to salvage, you know, scurry away a piece here and there.
Of course, not military either. There are others out there early on.
The ranchers and their families, their higher hand, and they had a, you know, systematically go from ranch to ranch and house to house, and they were even searching as far as the barracks and other places throughout the Roswell base, making sure they had every last shard of physical evidence.
Yeah.
But the bodies are something different. What are you going to all of a sudden, oh, here's an eyeball? Here's a finger? I mean, the point
go ahead.
It's much less, you know, difficult to, you know, box them up, get them as far as quickly off the base as possible, and prevent, you know, as far as keep them out of eye shot enough that the only people that are even aware that there were bodies are those who were only directly involved with them. And there you're talking about the hangar, you're talking about the base hospital, those who, Frederick Benthal, who was the photographer who took the pictures, and we have him on video. And a professional government photographer, military photographer.
You
and
shouldn't
unless we
take
forget,
this personally. You guys are being blacklisted. Come on, there's just no other way to look at it. You know too much. You present it too well. It's the truth. This material is not going to be broadcast. That's how serious they are about continuing this asinine cover-up. And they throw little pieces of this and that out to the public, and that's all you're going to get, people. Go ahead.
Well, let's look at it this way. How convenient that we were sitting on at least 150 first-hand witnesses to the event of the millennium.
Right.
could not, and then as certainly as anyone who's a student of Roswell, when we worked with the late Congressman Stephen Schiff of New Mexico, representing a number of his own constituents, and the way he was stonewalled by the White House, by the Pentagon.
I think they killed him, Don.
We did a show on that very possibility. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And the point being, we had our whistleblowers. They were actual whistleblowers. They were firsthand to the wreckage, to the cover-up, to the bodies. And we were never given our day in court. And how convenient that now, all of a sudden, at the point that the final Roswell witnesses are gone, well, now we can talk about it. Let's have hearings. Let's actually have whistleblowers come in and talk about the stories they've heard. How convenient.
Yeah. No.
And Roswell was never on the table. We had to insist that we go back to 1947 because originally they were only going to go back to 2004.
Now everything starts with Roswell. That's the big one. Did anybody successfully track or secondhand information? I'll take anything. The live ET, what happened to it? Do we know? Does anybody know?
Well, I can chime in, and if Don knows more, then just jump in. But we know that they were initially taken to the big hangar on the Roswell base. Then they went to the base hospital, and then they were flown out on one plane went out on July the 8th, 1947, piloted by Pappy Henderson. We think there was at least one body on that flight, plus wreckage. The next day, a B-29 flew one large box, one large wooden crate out. The size of it to me suggests that maybe up to three bodies. There were a total of four bodies plus the one that was alive. Well, the July 9 flight to me suggests there were three bodies, at least two, maybe three, in the big wooden crate that went to Fort Worth, Texas, Roswell, which became Carswell Air Force Base, but it was Fort Worth Army Airfield back in 47. And there was a mortician waiting for the plane on the flight line. So there was definitely biological material on that flight. So the bodies went from Fort Worth ultimately to Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio, where the live one was spotted the next year in the springtime by Lieutenant Colonel, Marine Lieutenant Colonel Black Mac Magruder. So the live one, maybe April or May of 1948. Now, as far as how long that one lasted, we don't know. We've heard several stories of when it might have perished. But like I said, there's several different stories. But ultimately, the only story I am aware of as far as what their ultimate disposition was, it comes from Officer George Weinbrenner, who was in charge of the FTD, the Foreign Technology Division at Wright Field, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base later. He, on his deathbed, he said that we have five of them, five aliens, that would be the five Roswell aliens, in Utah. Well, that would be the Dugway facility in Utah. Yeah. So that's as far as I know, Jeff. Perhaps Don knows something more than I do.
I'm glad you mentioned Weinbrenner, Tom, because when, and there too, that Hynek would go on to serve in the capacity with Foreign Technology after Blue Book was shut down in December of 1969. And we have copies of his work orders. We have copies of his job description. His assignment with Foreign Technology through the fall of 1973, 4 years after Blue Book was shut down, was consultant on controversial aerial phenomenon. To this day, we have people arguing that, well, it doesn't mean it was UFOs. Controversial aerial phenomenon? What else would it have been? And again, that was Hynek's expertise. And who was his boss at Foreign Technology but Colonel George Weinbrenner? So how the dots always connect, that they always come full circle. And
I've got to ask one thing relating to this, a live ET. Have you seen, you must have seen this, it's been around, the alleged stolen, I assume it's 16-millimeter film from Area 51, maybe S4, maybe somewhere else, of an ET in some kind of, we'll call it pulmonary trouble, being harassed by two Earthlings, a doctor and someone else. They were kind of hassling it, and it was dying. This video is online. Have you ever seen that, either one of you?
It does not ring a bell with
no,
me.
No, I'll find it. I'll find it.
It does for me, Jeff. And the principal advocate of that right now, and I believe he's run for public office in the state of Illinois. He resides in the Chicago area. His name is John Stewart. And I'm not talking about the comedian. And I know John has done the most, and he is a true proponent of that film.
That's a legit piece of film.
I'd be happy to arrange John to even be on the show with you.
Oh, please do.
At some time, given that you've mentioned that, because
I would very much like to. We'll put the video up, whatever he wants. I think that's legit video. I can't prove
I know,
it, but you just have that sense.
There are special effects people that suggest that it's almost like a Muppet, in that it almost it's. But given you know, it's providence given, you know, the history of it and the fact that nobody has been able to demonstrate as far as just like the alien autopsy footage, that no one has ever come forward to confess that they were the perpetrators, that they
it's
were
true.
The ones who did
it's
this.
True. No one has. That's right.
And so it keeps that that door open. So yes,
we'll get
I
that
will,
to you. Tom.
I'll contact like, John for you, and I'll make the arrangement for you. Be happy
thank
to.
Thank you, Don. That'd be great. Yeah, thank you very much. As I've been saying for the last 2 hours, we would not have Roswell if it weren't for these two gentlemen and Kevin Randall's contributions early on. We wouldn't. We wouldn't know anything. The government would have had their fat and sassy arrogance on display. And no, nothing happened to Roswell. It's just a weather balloon. Same old crap. And all the people. You know, one thing that you've, both of you have made crystal clear is that many, many of these people, because of the threats they were under and their national security oath and whatever, these people went through a miserable lifetime after that event. They didn't have, they had it tough, some of them, real tough. And I don't think that's ever been really properly presented either.
Well, I think the best one of the best examples is when.
Well,
we
in
first...
your books, yes, but other than that, on the big screen, on TV, no, it's not.
Well, no, I we would agree. And like Walter Hott, First Lieutenant Walter Hott, who was the public information officer, and they even hear from his wife Patricia, who was called Pete, and she worked for the Roswell Daily Record, but for to listen to her describe that they were getting threatening phone calls during the middle of the night, 3 o'clock in the morning, and this went on for 30 years. It's not just Walter making this claim. It's his wife who's also saying that she would pick up the phone thinking it was a family member who was in a dire situation, and there were these threats. Your husband ever says another word about 1947, you're all going to regret, you know.
Who
fabricates such things? Yeah. And to what end?
No, you don't.
But we're told constantly, well, they're liars. Look in the mirror, pal. You're the one that's having a problem dealing with the truth, not us.
I think we trace the perpetrator of that, some of those threats. It was the son of one of the Air Force squadron commanders at Roswell back
Kingsbury.
In
Kingsbury. Yeah.
Yes. It was his son. Wow. He calls me up. He says, my name is Colonel Forrestal. And I'm thinking, Forrestal, that was a Navy guy. and the ID on my phone says Kingsbury. He says, I'm Colonel Forrestal. He said, no, you're not, Mr. Kingsbury. And he hung up, but he was trying, I don't know what he was trying to do to me, but I think we had some, we had said something to somebody, and we traced this back to a General P.K. Carleton. Do you remember
P.K. Carleton in Denver, right.
Yes, we thought he was sort of the ringleader out west of trying to suppress talk about Roswell. And I don't remember now how we figured that out, but we did trace it back to P.K. Carleton, who was also at Roswell. He became ultimately a general.
A general,
Yeah, so, this Colonel Forrestal.
We are out of time. By the way, James Forrestal, in my opinion, and the opinion of many others, was also murdered. He was our first viable Secretary of Defense.
Yes, yes.
And he ended up in Bethesda, and they threw him out the window. He wanted to go public with a lot of things, and this was one of them. I really appreciate you too, as friends and colleagues, and what you've done, what your contribution has been, extraordinary. And I hope somebody will come forward and do the right thing and bring your work to a very wide audience. We need that done now. It's time that this cover-up, and boy, do they play that game, that cover-up game, tooth and nail for well over half a century. But all the principles are gone now, so guys and gals, you can lighten up a little bit, wouldn't you think? Anyhow.
Well, I'd like to think that with the even with the JFK files, that people are realizing more and more that if the government tells you one thing, believe the opposite.
Absolutely, Don. Don, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeff,
here.
For this opportunity for both of us. Yeah.
Of course, of course. Tom, thank you. Talk to you both soon. All righty. Okay. Take good care.
Tom, take care. Good talking with you, too. Okay. Bye-bye. Night.
Good night. And thank you all for being here. Just fascinating material. And I just think that it's one of the great stories of our times, period. No question. It's right there. Okay. Back with you tomorrow, Thursday. Talk to you then.